It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. Coming up, we'll find out about some recent recognition of the International Crane Foundation's work here in Wisconsin and around the world.
First, a new piece in the Wisconsin State Journal looks at how Governor Scott Walker's administration is responding to open records requests. It looks at two examples where the administration denied access because the records were transitory.
Matthew DeFore is with us to talk about the story. He's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me.
We'll get into the details in a minute of the specific denied open records request, but there's one theme you write that goes between them, the idea of transitory correspondence and whether that is something that has to be saved as an open record. So what's in that category?
Well, it's a category that's existed, but they've recently changed the definition to be a little bit more specific about what kinds of things are transitory records. And it includes things like communications between staff to just talk about scheduling. So something like, hey, we're going out to get lunch. That's something that they, I think, are explicitly, when they made these changes, that's what they had in mind. But from our reporting, we're just finding two examples, at least, where we've been told we can't get access to records that we know existed at one time, but don't appear to exist anymore, and we're being told it's because they were transitory. Well, we don't necessarily agree.
So let's get into those cases now. One, in the ongoing saga of WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, you write, there was a loan. There appears to be some kind of record that once existed, no longer does.
So the record that we are trying to get a copy of is text messages among the Department of Administration staff. Now, as our reporting had previously shown, Mike Hipsch, Secretary of DOA at the time, and his higher-ups were working very diligently to get this loan to a company that was struggling and whose owner had given a $10,000 donation to Governor Walker. They had hired a well-connected lobbyist. And so there's a lot of questions about why exactly they were so keen on getting this guy money. It turned out he misrepresented himself on his loan. But as we're trying to just understand that better, we saw in an email that there was a text message conversation about that loan, and so we wanted to get the text message. But we were told it doesn't exist, and so we said, well, what do you mean it doesn't exist? We've got an email showing that they were texting about this. And they said, well, it's a transitory record, doesn't have to be retained. And so that's kind of sort of a red flag for us. What do you mean it's not being maintained anymore?
And the idea is, this is under that category, they're saying, of a transitory correspondence that they don't have to keep on file.
Right, and the public policy issue here is, what's the recourse? If it's a record that they think shouldn't be public, and they have that record in their possession, if the public disagrees, it can go to court. It can ask the Attorney General whether they think that's the right call. But if a records custodian says that a record is transitory and gets rid of it, and then they later, for whatever reason, you are able to find out that they were having text message conversations and want to come back and get those records, and they tell you it's transitory, there's really no recourse. There's really no appeals process for the public to say, well, we disagree with your decision on that. And so I think that's the public policy issue that was raised in this article.
Well, getting with the intent of this idea of a transitory correspondence, there might be a text that says, hey, I'm on my way to the meeting about this WEDIC loan. I'm stuck in traffic. I'm going to be 5 minutes late. That is something that would clearly be transitory. The public isn't served by keeping that on file. So there's some things that would fit this category, right?
Absolutely. And what we just don't know is exactly what those text messages say. What we do know is that there was an email from Chris Shaner, who was one of the people involved in pushing this thing to WEDC. And he basically said, hey, he sent an email to William Minahan, who's the guy applying for the state loan. And he said, hey, we were just talking, and in parentheses he says, or should I say texting about you. The secretary wants to meet with you tomorrow, and this is right before they forwarded this entire package to WDC. So we just would like to know more about what they were texting about. And if it was something that was legitimately transitory, it's possible, but open records advocates we talked to seem to think, that's not necessarily the case.
And the fear would be, and you write that this has been a concern at the municipal level too, is that if texts are regarded as transitory, then public officials could have behind-the-scenes print conversations in text form about policy matters to get around open records laws.
Right. Well, in the city of Madison, this is a story that came out in 2012, city council members were emailing and texting to each other during actual city council debates. So rather than having these discussions about the merits of a new ordinance or of economic development proposal out in public where people can hear them, they were discussing it on text messages. And so afterwards, the city of Madison changed its ordinance or its guidance on this to say city officials should not use text messages unless they can somehow guarantee that those records are retained. And so I think the Attorney General said something fairly similar in that public officials shouldn't really be using text messages to discuss official business. And so that's at least our current understanding.
We're talking to reporter Matt DeFore about open records in Wisconsin. You can see his piece on the topic at madison.com. Let's get into this other test case you write about who visited Governor Walker's Maple Bluff residence. What's the story there?
About a month ago, the One Wisconsin Now had put out a press release about a records denial that they had also received. And it was very similar. The denial from the Department of Administration was that we don't have records prior to a certain date. These records, they are daily police reports that Capitol Police have that show who is expected to come to the executive residence on a given day. They had these records from April 8th onward, so they provided those records, but they didn't provide them prior to April 8th. And their explanation was they're not required to keep them, and so they just didn't have them. They got rid of them. And it's not entirely clear why they had them even going back to April 8th. But the issue again there is there's a different part of the records retention policy that's separate from transitory records that talks about the like visitors' logs or logs of who's coming in and out of a state building. And under that, you're supposed to keep them for at least a year. So, again, we just don't know why they weren't following that policy. And again, if the public disagrees with how they're handling transitory records, or if they're labeling something transitory that's not, I don't quite understand how they can, there's really not an appeals process. There's not real, a recourse for the public. So,
who is the decider? Who makes the decisions of what our open records policy is in the state?
Well, the records, the law as to what is an open record is in statute. But in terms of how long you have to keep those records, that's set by the Public Records Board, which is, as I found, this sort of obscure 8-member board that we don't really ever hear much about. And they're not setting very tight timelines for these records to be retained. I mean, in the case of correspondence among secretaries and top officials, those records are supposed to be maintained for 3 years after the person leaves office. So there's, rarely any times you see that a record can be destroyed immediately. But in the case of the new transitory policy that they adopted in August, that policy says that transitory records they don't have to be maintained at all. And previously it just said that they had to be maintained until they're no longer needed, which may not be much of a distinction, but It's just, again, there's no time then to appeal a decision to destroy something if, in fact, it's not transitory.
And Matt, open records for a brief period in the state were a huge issue with an attempt to change open records laws in the budget process, in the last minutes of the budget process. Do you see any bleed over, any crossover between that and what you're writing about this week?
Well, there was an attempt to change the state open records law, especially dealing with, again, these behind-the-scenes conversations. There's a lawsuit that the Center for Media and Democracy, the liberal advocacy group, has filed challenging Governor Walker's decision to deny certain internal deliberative email conversations or some kind of records related to the Wisconsin idea, that whole thing that was first taken out of the state law. And so, yeah, there's definitely sort of this back and forth about what do you do about these internal deliberations, which are perhaps increasingly happening over textual conversations and less over phone calls or group meetings. And government wants to be efficient, I guess, and so text messages might be an efficient way to communicate, but they also are going to get caught under the open records law. So
we'll leave it there for now. Matt, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Matthew DeFore, state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about Governor Walker's administration and open records requests. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, why our culture appreciates funny men more than funny women.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. The International Crane Foundation, based in Baraboo, works around the world to save cranes. Producer Brianne Shasso spent a day at its headquarters learning about its conservation work with whooping cranes.
How long ago did the chick hatch?
20 minutes, maybe. Yeah, 15 minutes? Cranes. Just out. We asked this chick not to hatch until this morning so that you can see it.
That's Bryant Tarr, curator of birds for the International Crane Foundation.
So this bird has been in the other room for 2 days now when it started peeping. Then it pipped, which is it makes that first little hole in the shell, and then it rests for about 24 hours. And then the next day it just saws its way around and pops out, and that's what just happened.
We're silent in the room where the chick is kept. Tarr lets me peek in the incubator at the chick after turning out the light so he or she can't see me. The chick, who has a June birthday, is damp, brown, and maybe a little bigger than a tennis ball, showing no signs yet of the snowy plumage it'll one day have. The chick will later be named Phantom, following this year's theme of naming the whooping crane chicks after Wisconsin lakes. She is part of the foundation's Direct Autumn Release Program, which began in 2005. Phantom will spend the next few months learning how to be a crane from scientists wearing crane suits. Costume rearing helps the chicks avoid imprinting on humans and is something the foundation began experimenting with in the 1980s.
My name is Marianne Wellington, and I am a lead aviculturist and a chick rearing supervisor.
Wellington's work includes spending the coming months, along with others, wearing white costumes mimicking whooping cranes and carrying MP3 players that play sounds a parent crane would make for the chicks. The costumes cover people from head to toe and include a puppet worn on one of the person's hands that resembles a crane's head. There's absolutely no talking.
I learned a lot from other species on what I should or shouldn't do in costume, or what I can and can't do in costume. When you're wearing a costume, your puppet is on your hand, and so you need to think about the fact that your hand acts like a head, and so your hand has to be looking at different things. So when an airplane goes over, you cock your head a little bit so that one eye is looking up at the airplane or at the hawk flying over. But if it's a hawk or something they're not sure about, they'll start watching longer and longer, and you're like, oh, what is that? And so you just need to learn to freeze. And so for me, it is more of a, if I think about it correctly, it's more of a zen interaction, trying to be a crane as much as I can.
In the fall, the whooping crane chicks are released near older whooping cranes so they can learn the migration route south.
It's a time of lots of emotions. So you're sad because you're letting these animals that you were working with so much, you get attached to them. It's hard not to. You get attached to them, so it's sad to see them go. But there's this fantastic feeling to see them fly. And I see them fly anyway. From day to day, taking them out, they fly, and it's amazing that they come back. It's just amazing. But to see them fly and be cranes in the wild, it's just fantastic.
In early November, 8 whooping crane chicks were released. 2 other chicks, one of which is Phantom, were kept because of their good genetics.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk more about the efforts to help cranes is Rich Belfus, president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks. Great to be on with you.
Well, Rich, we'll talk to you some more about the efforts to restore the whooping crane in the country. But first, I want to talk about we clearly heard the emotion there from the person working with cranes in that Wisconsin Life piece. How attached do you feel there to the cranes you work with at the Crane Foundation?
Ah, that's great. And thank you so much for doing that story. That was a really fun story. Mm-hmm. Yes, our group and those who come to get to know us get very, very attached to these birds. It's an amazing experience up here in Baraboo. You can all see all 15 species of cranes of the world. and visitors get very attached to the birds. They see them up close, and, you know, they're very large birds, and you sort of look at them eye to eye. And our staff that work with the birds develop very close relationships with the birds because they do so much intimate work with them, raising them in costume, raising them from chicks up until they can actually migrate. And it's very emotional to have the birds ultimately fledge into the wild. So,
what are the chances like of the chicks you raise and are released? Are the chances pretty good that they'll make it and survive again for another year and beyond?
It's a very step-by-step process. There's all kinds of wonderful things that have come from reintroducing the birds to the wild. They're pairing up, which is a big step. Cranes are very selective in their mates, and so part of the challenge is just getting them to pair up in the wild. They're migrating back and forth long distances, and the pairs are laying eggs, and they're hatching chicks. And the big challenge is getting those chicks to rear up to adults in the wild, ultimately. And there's lots of things that go after chicks in the wild, from bird predators to raccoons and possums and all sorts of things, and many challenges. And so part of it is just seeing them through and making it ultimately to becoming breeding birds themselves so that they can sustain the population in the wild.
As we heard, part of the success there is going to be making sure those birds don't imprint on humans early on. And this is not a trivial issue. You've got a crane there, I think not a whooping crane, but another kind of crane, who did imprint on humans very, very early in her life, I think it was.
Yeah, they can. The birds, once the chicks hatch, they'll imprint very quickly on the first thing they see. And some of the very early whooping crane reintroductions, which were done out in Idaho back in the 70s, there was an attempt to get whoopers back in the wild by hatching the eggs in sandhill chicks, which seemed like a good idea. They would learn to migrate with the sandhills and learn their old migration routes that were lost. But the problem was that they imprinted on sandhills and thought they were sandhills back then. So we put an extraordinary amount of effort now into having those chicks imprint on whooping cranes, either through rearing the chicks with whooping crane live adults, which is a natural parent rearing method, or having their first exposure to be people, but in costumes that look just like whooping cranes, so that they still have a very strong association and identity of themselves as whooping cranes. So that's much of the work, and as you captured on that little clip from our site, in order to do that, we have to really minimize human sounds and really make it a very crane-like youth experience for these chicks as they grow.
How is whooping crane conservation going right now in the United States and beyond?
Well, whooping crane conservation is both a great success story and a huge challenge. The whole reason that we're reintroducing, you know, these birds back in the eastern part of the U.S., releasing the birds in Wisconsin, is our concern over the original wild flock. And those birds migrate. They breed way, way up in northern Canada in a place called Wood Buffalo National Park. And then they winter along the coast of Texas at Aransas National Wildlife Refuge. And that original flock got as low as 15 birds back in the 1940s, and they've recovered to about 300 now. But it's a very vulnerable flock, certainly one of the rarest birds in North America. And those birds have a long migration route, and there's challenges all along the way, missing power lines, occasionally getting shot by people on the route, and especially on their wintering grounds down in Texas, where you have land development issues, lack of fresh water, and problem with droughts, and many challenges down on the wintering ground. So we're working on a lot of those problems throughout their range, working very intensively with those wild birds. But the reintroduction was very much in part to kind of hedge our bets and to have a second population separate from the birds that migrate between Canada and Texas to increase the overall chance that the birds will ultimately survive. So it's very much part of the strategy and the challenge. So we're delighted that the birds have recovered. Like I said, there's more than 300 in the wild now and more than 600 in existence, which is a wonderful story, but still a long way to go to really secure the birds in the wild.
You mentioned those power lines, and I understand there's some, I think, kind of low-tech efforts to help whooping cranes avoid flying into power lines as they migrate.
Yeah, one of the challenges with power lines is really where they're sighted, and generally the cranes can see them pretty well, but when you have power lines that are sighted close to where the birds roost, say on a river or in a wetland, or if you have power lines in a place where the chicks are just learning to fly and sort of taking some of their first flights, they're particularly vulnerable. They're not good at evading power lines, and they may not see them if there's cloudy weather or they fly in to a resting site after dark and things like that. So a lot of it, a lot of the work is really in getting power lines sited correctly in the first place to avoid really critical areas. And then you have a lot more flexibility in broader areas. And then we also do marking of lines in certain areas so they have some kind of reflective material on them to make them a little bit easier to see. So there's a whole bunch of things we can do to try and prevent that impact. But getting them in the right place in the first place is really, really important.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, how can people who are listening help with crane conservation?
Well, we have a lot of loyal supporters. We're really, really grateful to everyone who supports our efforts. Get to know us better is the first thing I would suggest. We have a website and you can find easily on the International Crane Foundation. We work with a lot of great partners, and come and visit us. And Baraboo is a great place to learn more about our work. And one of the exciting things this time of year is we've also got thousands and thousands of sandhills around in the state, the sandhill crane, which is our most abundant crane. And a lot of people come and enjoy those in the wild and the area all around ICF. We probably have 10,000 in the wild near us right now. And great opportunity to experience cranes up close and learn more about conservation efforts for them.
Well, Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Rich Belfis is the president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation based in Baraboo.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at President Obama's primetime address on terrorism and security.
First, many women are playing a higher profile role in the comedy world these days. While there have always been prominent women in comedy, Lucille Ball, Carol Burnett, just a couple names that pop to one's mind, there seem to be more big names on bigger stages. Here are Tina Fey and Amy Poehler kicking off the Golden Globe Awards this year.
You bunch of despicable, spoiled, minimally talented brats. Yes. We are so happy to be here hosting the 72nd and final Golden Globe Awards. We got it. Tonight we celebrate all the great television shows that we know and love, as well as all the movies that North Korea was okay with.
Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, but outside of the entertainment world, in personal lives, workplaces, romantic relationships, our next guest writes that there's still a big difference. A funny man is appreciated, but a funny woman may not be. And a lot of research suggests that there's a double standard at work.
Olga Kazan joins us now. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine. Her piece on men, women, and humor is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Olga, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you write that both men and women often say that they're looking for someone with a sense of humor when it comes to romantic relationships. So far, so good. But it doesn't necessarily mean they're looking for the same thing. What do women and men mean when they say that, according to some of the research you looked at?
Right. So when researchers really press people as to, well, what qualities are you really looking for in a romantic partner? It turns out that men say they want someone who will actually laugh at their jokes, and women tend to say that they want someone who will make them laugh. But both genders consider that to be, you know, sense of humor, but it's actually quite different.
So how do men feel about women who are funny, who are looking for the laughs?
So it's not clear cut. So there are obviously men out there who appreciate funny women, and I think a lot of men appreciate funny comedians in particular. But there are some studies that show that men actually don't rate a sense of humor very highly in their romantic partners, as far as like ability to tell jokes. And in fact, when they do find a romantic partner or a prospective romantic partner, they actually prefer that she not be funny.
So why, and yeah, you cite some research that says, oh, yeah, she's goofy and saying funny stuff. Who's next? Let's find somebody else, maybe. So why is that? Why are some men, maybe not all men, but some men at least, put off by a funny woman?
So it's kind of interesting, but part of it is driven. There's all these evolutionary theories behind it, which is that, you know, women face more risks in childbearing, so they have to find a man who's really fit and he's going to be a great dad. And one way that they sort of check for that or try to make sure that they're going to find a man who's really smart and talented is they try to find a funny man, because, you know, most people don't brag about their SAT scores after they're about 18 years old. So they look look for funniness in their mates so that they can make sure that they're going to be smart and capable. And men don't really face those same calculations when they're looking for romantic partners. They're more looking for someone who's just going to be really, I guess, sort of fit to have children. And that's not really the same thing. And so unfortunately, you know, the studies do show that that men kind of really overlook this sort of quality of humor in their mates.
So that's where it gets kind of sticky, though, isn't it? Because women want men who are smart, and in this case, smart equals funny. So does that mean, kind of by the same property there, that men don't want women who are smart?
So again, not all men, and there are obviously exceptions to every rule, and I'm not sure that every man or most men would even admit to this, but there is a study that shows that men actually prefer women to not be as smart as they are, as far as dating.
You mentioned evolutionary biology, and maybe there's something there. I think sometimes maybe people read too much into that, but maybe there's a cultural side to this, and you also write that men early on are encouraged to be jokey and funny, and whether they're funny or not, men tend to try to tell jokes a lot more than women. Is this a matter of cultural reinforcement from an early age?
Yeah, I think people are sort of socialized into these different social roles where it's, kind of more encouraged and more acceptable for men to always be telling jokes. Men get more credit for their jokes when, you know, people look at a list of funny captions or one-liners. They misattribute them to male writers for some reason. Men also rate themselves as funnier than women do after they've written some jokes. And then there are also these kind of, people who looked at like things like ratings of professors at different universities. And it turns out that, you know, very rarely are female professors rated as being funny, but male professors, that's like one of the top terms for what they're considered to be.
And it seems like a lot of women just don't think of themselves as funny. They don't try. So is part of it just societal conditioning then?
I think it is. I mean, I think, you know, and when you look at these, it's sort of supported by the research, because when you look at some of these studies where they have people try to be funny, and they're saying, you know, okay, caption all of these New Yorker cartoons, men will write kind of more captions. They'll take more shots at being funny. And the women don't write as many captions. And you know, at the same time, the men, it's not like every single thing that comes out of their mouths is gold. It's sort of, there's a lot of misses, there's a lot of hits, but, you know, they just try more, so they hit more. And that's sort of, I think, where the cultural conditioning comes into play.
Talking to Olga Kazan from the Atlantic magazine about men, women, and humor and different perceptions. People like the funny men, maybe not so much with the funny women. And Olga, you write that some women, and you have some anecdotes along with the research you talk about, women might be hilarious among their friends, their woman friends, but not seen as funny in their work lives or maybe by men they date. What accounts for that difference in those two different worlds?
So I think that women in general do tend to laugh a lot more than men do. They smile and laugh a lot more. But as far as when they're telling jokes, what sort of researchers find is that in mixed company, men sort of tell a lot of jokes and women don't. Women joke a lot more, but only when there's no men around. And I think part of that is sort of internalizing this idea that their humor production, you know, their jokes that they tell or that they write just aren't as valuable as those of men. And so I think maybe they save those for when they're in like kind of a safer, more female space.
And didn't you write about some research, too, that when women wanted to, I guess, maybe date a guy, that they laughed extra hard and loud when there was that desirable male around?
Right, yeah. So what they find is that sort of predicts, like, whether the couple will hit it off or not, is if the woman is laughing a lot. And so that's part of that, because it's kind of like a mating signal, I guess.
So this article was headlined, "The Plight of the Funny Female." So what is a single funny woman to do? Is the only option to dumb it down, to tone down the hilarity?
I mean, I think that's the more depressing option. I don't know if you would really want to spend your life with a different personality.
Right.
So I mean, you know, women have different ways of coping with this. You know, I think some of the women that I talked to, I thought, you know, kind of one smart strategy was that they just wouldn't change their personality at all. They would just be themselves, you know, just the way they are, and sort of whoever didn't like it, they could tell wasn't worth dating. So that's kind of how they, like, narrowed down their romantic prospects, I guess.
This kind of reminds me of that book, The Rules. It was back in, what, the 80s or something like that, maybe the 90s, about rules for dating if you want to get married in 2 years. And women were supposed to be, they were supposed to wear black nylons, and they were supposed to be mysterious. So I think being funny is sort of the opposite of being mysterious. So it makes you wonder if there's something to all of that when it comes to mating rituals.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think that the rules is really outdated, and I think very few people would kind of outwardly attest to thinking that that's a good idea anymore. But it's just that these sort of more old-fashioned, you know, ideas about gender and gender relations, they take a long time to change. So even if people might say, you know, oh, that's not me, that's not what I want, you know, it just takes a long time to change something as basic as attraction or just even like friendship between two people.
Do we see a change happening? And maybe is it coming from popular culture? We mentioned at the outset, there are a lot of big names, female comedians out there. Amy Schumer headlining. You wrote Madison Square Garden, the first woman comic to do that. Are we seeing some top-down change that could affect the rest of us over time?
I think, I actually do think, I mean, this is just my personal opinion. I didn't look at any studies of professional female comedians, but, you know, the kind of embrace of people like Amy Schumer, and even before that, you know, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and such, I really feel like both men and women appreciate her almost equally. And, you know, she is sort of a feminist icon, but she's also, you know, I think a lot of men would just say she's really funny. And I think that, you know, once you do have a lot more acceptance of people like that at the top, hopefully that trickles down. You know, you can only hope that that kind of opens up the field for women who aren't, you know, professionally funny, but just are a little bit brash or outgoing sometimes, and that that's seen as sort of more acceptable and even good sometimes.
We're talking about women, men, and humor with Olga Kazan from Atlantic Magazine. In a recent piece, she writes that funny men tend to be appreciated more than funny women, and she looks at some of the latest research on gender and humor.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that funny women are underappreciated? Why does that happen? Do you see this at play maybe at your workplace, in your dating life, in among your friends? Do men have more room, more space to crack jokes? Women, not as much? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic Magazine, talking about her piece called The Plight of the Funny Female. She writes about research showing that men's sense of humor tends to be appreciated more than women's.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this your experience? Do you see differences between the way men and women are funny? Do you look for the funny in your dating life? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go right to a caller. We've got Jennifer on the line in Appleton. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say that, you know, this isn't really a great surprise. I think that if any of us would say, let's do this research, let's look at how men's humor and women's humor is perceived, I think any of us who are, you know, over the age of 40 could say, oh, let me guess. Men are, their jokes are laughed at more. Boys' jokes in middle school are laughed at more than girls' jokes. Boys' jokes in second grade are laughed more than girls' jokes in second grade because boys are listened to more. They're paid attention to more. They're, you know, they're what girls compete for, typically. And so, you know, it's just, I really liked when the person said, well, one depressing response would be to dumb down or, you know, to just go crazy when you think you're really funny and nobody's listening, and then the boy next to you or the person at the workplace or whatever says something that is moderately funny and everybody falls all over them. So it's just more of, you know, how we raise girls and boys in our culture.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for bringing that up. So Olga, this talk about humor is a subset of, she says, more attention being paid to boys and later men in general.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about a more attention. That would be hard to measure. But one thing that I think has been shown in the research is that sort of when boys are sort of pranksters, like little boys are sort of pranksters or class clowns, that's seen as like a little bit more acceptable than that same behavior coming from a girl. The stereotype is that girls will be more the good, the good student and like kind of quiet. And so I do think that plays into it, where it's sort of seen as like a little bit more okay for a little boy to act that way, and that sort of just continues.
Did you see anything in your research that equated being funny with having power? Is there a parallel to be drawn there?
So there is, but it's sort of not the way you think. It's about people laugh more at people who are powerful. So it's not like the funnier you are, the more powerful you are, if that makes sense. Hmm.
So you laugh at the boss's joke, whether it's funny or not.
Exactly. So the boss could be like terrible, but you still have to laugh at him because he signs your check.
We've all been there, I think. Not yeah. Currently. I want to emphasize, not currently.
Rob, we need
definitely
these jobs.
Not now.
Let's go to the callers now. We've got Stephen on the line in Eagle. Stephen, hi.
Hi. I think it's a great program we have here. I appreciate what you're saying. I would agree with you, but in my life, I find women to be a lot funnier. Whitney Cummings is one who I love, and then there's a show that's late. It's on Nick at Night. It's called Mom's Night Out, and they have a majority of women comedians. And again, there I find them to be hilarious. And so, yeah, I definitely appreciate what you're saying. I don't disagree with you at all. But in my life, I happen to find women to be much funnier.
So. All right. Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate you calling in. And Olga, Stephen thinks women are funnier. And now that we've got, more women out there on the comedy circuit, do you expect we're going to start seeing, as you said, more people who think like Stephen does?
I feel like this is totally anecdotal, but I feel like the number of shows geared around women, and specifically women being funny for their kind of in their own right without, it being around like romantic foibles, I think they've really proliferated. And I think that's great. I think more people who are exposed to that kind of thing and appreciate that, I think that's a positive thing.
Thanks for that call, Stephen. We're talking to Olga Kazan from The Atlantic and talking about her recent piece on men and women and humor and perceptions of who's funnier. We'll go back to our callers now with Lars in Madison. Lars, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I was thinking about two things. One is I host karaoke shows for a living, and I've discovered one thing. There's a very thin line between being funny and being mean. And I wonder if a lot of women's reluctance about being funny is not wanting to be on the wrong side of that line.
Oh, interesting. So, sometimes funny can be mean-spirited funny or walking that fine line there. Do you think that's a part of the story here, Olga?
Yeah, so that's actually another article that I had written in the past. Is just about how most things that you consider funny have an element of like something a little bit dark. Usually things have to be a little bit dark in order to be funny. And I do think that women kind of try to be nicer. They're socialized to be nicer. So in trying to avoid that sort of dark or kind of mean-spirited talk, you might also kind of avoid being funny just kind of by coincidence.
Well, Lars, thanks a lot for that, and we're going to go on to Dennis in Oshkosh. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I think women's humor is actually smarter. Guys would rather see another guy get hit in the groin and laugh at that than have to think about it, a smart joke. That's what I feel.
All right. That's one that's been brought up before, Dennis. Thanks for raising that. Some people say women's humor smarter, or men like the slapstick humor more like the Three Stooges kind of thing. But I don't know, is that putting too fine a point on it, Olga?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they like it more necessarily, but one thing that does seem to happen in these studies is that men will write a lot of, like, kind of the really lowbrow jokes and a lot of the really good jokes. So they seem to veer toward either end of the spectrum.
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Teresa on Facebook who writes, "If I goof off with anyone other than my Girl Scouts and swim kids, I feel like I'm no longer taken as seriously and my opinion is not acknowledged." So that's one that might be a big deal, especially at a workplace, Olga. Any research on that and whether we're prone to take women less seriously if they're funny at the workplace versus men?
Oh, you know, that's a super interesting point, and I didn't look into that. But I could totally see that being, you know, this guy who happens to be funny is still seen as, like, a really competent person who can do their job well. But a woman who goofs off a lot is seen as sort of not serious or kind of a joke. I think that's an interesting concern and, something to look into.
Well, there's all that research out there now about women speaking less in the workplace in general, so it seems like it would stand to reason that they would also joke less, that it might be part of that same parcel of what's going on in sort of work gap.
Yeah. So women definitely, I mean, they do speak less at work in mixed company, and so joking less is sort of part of that. It's part of that kind of cultivating sort of a quiet, more reserved personality in the workplace, yeah.
So, Olga, we've been trying to figure out how this plays out in our workplace here, and for a while trying to not laugh at each other's jokes. That never lasts very long. I just want to ask you, do you see this in your own life, Olga, these differences and how they play out?
I don't know. I mean, I work with a lot of really, really hilarious women, so I can't say that this was sort of inspired by my workplace. I guess in the past, guys I've dated, I feel like that's not been a thing that's, like, been important to them, is, like, humor in their partners. At work, it's interesting. We actually have, like, a very, like, funny female office, which has sort of been nice, yeah.
And if someone's listening now, a woman, and she wants to try to correct some of this humor gap that we're talking about, do you think a woman could just get out there, go back to work tomorrow, and try to crack some jokes that she wouldn't normally crack?
I think that's definitely, you know, if you work in a kind of environment where people joke around and you notice men joking around a lot, I think that's definitely a good thing to do. Some workplaces I've found are just more reserved in general, so maybe not. But and also in your romantic life, if you, you know, it can be, like, some of these women I interviewed found a good filter if you start joking around and the guy you're with from Tinder or whatever doesn't like it.
Do you talk to some of the researchers who have been looking into this? Did you get a sense as to whether they were optimistic that things are going to change, that we're going to have more parity in how we view humor for men and women?
No, actually, no. I'm sorry. No, they seemed not optimistic. One of them was, like, sort of optimistic. She said, you know, maybe eventually the norms will change and you know, things will be different. But the rest of them were the evolutionary people. Really, were like, well, this has been the case for, you know, thousands of years, so it's not going to change tomorrow.
Wow.
And then the one who was a psychologist was also not very optimistic.
So it's sort of biology is destiny, so women are sort of destined not to be as funny, according to some scientists. That's kind of crazy to wrap your head around.
Well, it was more just romantic preferences or destiny. Like, okay. So, yeah.
I don't know if I buy that. I mean, I tend to lean toward the power of culture sometimes over biology when it comes to our behavior. I think it could change. I don't know. Olga,
yeah, I mean, let's hope so.
Do you think so?
Do I?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it can. I think especially with, what you were saying with the female comedians and just in general, how much I feel like our culture has become more feminist in recent years. And so I think hopefully this will be just another part of that.
So as we said, we've got this watershed moment right now. We've got Amy Schumer out there. We've got Tina Fey. We've got Amy Poehler. A lot of Amy's for whatever reason. But, I mean, do you think that, you know, they're joking, they're being more brash, they're being more explicit in their humor, and I just wonder if, you know, women are going to follow suit there and or whether these three women, this trio of power and more, are sort of unicorns, whether they're special.
You know, I don't know that they're... necessarily unicorns, just because I feel like we are, they're just, I don't know if you've heard about the Bechdel test, but there, you know, there's that thing for a while where it's like there's so few movies or TV shows where it's two women talking to each other about anything other than a man. Hmm. But I do feel like some of these new shows really go against that, and they're a lot more progressive than that.
Olga, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Olga Kazan, staff writer at The Atlantic. Her piece on men, women, and humor is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.